Hello and welcome to Seriously, with me, Femi Martin. 2016 is the centenary of Roald Dahl's birth, and as part of the Love to Read campaign, the BBC is celebrating Roald Dahl's life with a series of documentaries and dramas. You can find the full listing at the Radio 4 website, but here's something to whet your Dahl appetite.
It's a funny thing about mothers and fathers. Even when their own child is the most disgusting little blister you could ever imagine, they still think that he or she is wonderful. Occasionally one comes across parents who don't know how wonderful their child will turn out to be. Mr. and Mrs. Dahl were two such parents. They lived in Wales, and 100 years ago they had a son called Roald, who would come to be known as one of the world's greatest storytellers, who'd write stories that would be loved by millions and millions of people and told and retold all around the world in books and films and theatres and on radio programmes like this one. So to celebrate what would have been his 100th birthday, here he is, my grandfather, telling his own story in his own words. Roald, in an interview on Norwegian TV station NRK. Mr. and Mrs. Dahl came from Norway, so Roald grew up speaking Norwegian. That is, when he began to talk at all.
Norwegian was my first language because I had a Norwegian nurse. And I was a bit backward. I didn't speak one word until I was two, and just before my mother was going to take me to the doctor to see what kind of brain damage I had. My father came into the nursery and out came a whole sentence in Norwegian, which was, "Father, you've forgotten to put your bedroom slippers on." And then there were claps and screams.
Until he was 3 years old, my grandfather had a happy life in a big house near Cardiff.
I had a marvellous family life. I had a large family around me. Not my father, who died when I was three, but my wonderful Norwegian mother. We were living in Wales. And I had three sisters and a half-sister, making four, and a half-brother, five, me, six.
The terrible thing that caused my great-grandfather's death was the sudden loss of his seven-year-old daughter, my great-aunt Ostrie, who died of a burst appendix. But my great-grandmother, my namesake, Sophie Magdalene Dahl, was a strong woman.
The secret of my mother was minding her own business and always being there if she's wanted. Then you gravitate towards her. She is there like a great big rock.
With Sophie in charge, family life continued to be full of surprising events, some of which would turn up again many years later.
Dahl, I have found that the nose is such an important instrument in many of your stories.
That may be partly because my nose suffered so much in my own life. It was hanging on by a little bit in a car accident when I was a little boy, sitting in the back of the car with my mother when my eldest sister drove into the hedge. And then, of course, in the war, I got it squashed in. It's not the most important feature if you're describing a person's face. And nor are the eyes. Most writers describe the eyes, and they say he had steely blue eyes or sparkling blue eyes or some rot like that. The most important feature is the mouth. I mean, the mouth tells you everything. If you're angry, it is shown. If you're frightened, it's shown. If you're lustful, it's shown. You lick your lips and all that. If you see people with little pinched-up mouths, they're usually mean people. Mouths like dogs' bottoms, you know.
There were lots of mouths like dogs' bottoms at boarding school, where Roald went when he was seven.
I was sent to one of these disgusting English boarding prep schools, which is torture, you know, to be sent away, a little boy of seven. But my mother, who was not English, was told it was the right thing to do. And we used to hate it, and we were homesick, and we got beaten.
I can't conceive of doing it myself, and I don't quite know how they did it, actually wounding someone in cold blood. Maybe one should have a sort of beating machine, you see, and get rid of the beater. A great steel box you went into, and you, what would you do? You'd plug it in, and you could have a dial on it saying one stroke or two or three or four, and put it there. It should also have a knob on it saying hard, medium, or soft, you know, like boiled eggs almost. You'd sell that to half the schools in the country, I should think.
It didn't scar you?
Physically, very slightly. I mean, if I sit on a hard seat for about 2 hours, I then begin to feel my heart actually beating along the stripes on my bottom where they were.
But with that curious wisdom that seems to come so often to children in times of hardship, he began to find things to make life bearable. My grandfather would tell a famous story of how he put a dead mouse in a jar of gobstoppers belonging to the local sweet shop owner, Mrs. Pratchett, after she was horrible to him and his friends. It was another childhood incident that was to stay in his imagination forever.
In your latest book, Matilda, Lavender puts a little animal in the water jug of the teacher. That reminded me of something you told about yourself in Boy, where you put a dead mouse in the among the sweets in a goodie shop. Do you draw from childhood often?
Yes, I think one unconsciously draws from childhood. You probably don't even remember it exactly, but when you're trying to think of something, it comes back, probably. Yes. The mouse one was true, of course, in Boy, because that was an autobiography. But the little animal, the newt in the jug of water in Matilda, that was made up, of course.
But after Mrs. Pratchett complained to their headmaster, there was no making up an escape.
We all went back to our classrooms, and then a message came in asking for the five of us to report immediately to the headmaster's study. Off we went, trembling. When we got there, the headmaster was standing up in the middle of the room with a long, thin cane in his hands. He ticked us off, told us that we were going to be punished, and told us also to line up against the side of the study. Well, I knew that boys got beaten in the school, but I never knew that they watched each other getting beaten. I was last in the line, and he told Thwaites, I think he was first, to bend over, and he gave him four colossal cracks, and he went hopping out of the room, clutching his buttocks and whimpering. Then the next one got the same treatment, and then the next, and the next. On the second or third one, I'm not sure what it was, we suddenly got the shock of our lives, because from the far corner of the room came Mrs. Pratchett's voice, saying, "That's it, lay into him, headmaster, give it to him," and all that sort of thing. And we looked round, and there was this foul old hag sitting in an armchair watching. And when I came up, I remember her yelling, "That's the nastiest of the lot. You lay into him, headmaster. Don't let him off." And I limped out, clutching my buttocks and whimpering, and off we went.
There was one marvellous thing about boarding school. Chocolate.
When I was at boarding school, when we were 15, 16, 17, the big Cadbury's chocolate factory in England, for some reason they chose my school and my house in the school, and the housemaster was sent 80 boxes of chocolate in plain brown cardboard, I remember it, and you opened it up and inside were about 8 different bars of chocolate with different things in the middle, and you marked each chocolate from 1 to 10 marks, and you made a comment: rotten, delicious, beastly, too bitter, too sweet, anything. But that told me, and it would tell anyone, that inside these giant chocolate factories there is an inventing room where men and women in white coats, scientists, are walking around trying to make new and delicious chocolates. It's something I longed to be when I was young, you know, sitting in the lab of the factory and suddenly inventing the dairy milk flake and grabbing it and rushing along the corridor to Mr. Rowntree or Mr. Cadbury and screaming, "I've got it, sir, I've got it," you see. And he would then, behind his great desk, he would take one bite and munch it slowly, and I'd be standing in front of him waiting, and he'd say, "You've got it, that's it, tremendous, your salary's trebled," and all the rest of it, you see. Those are the dreams you have.
It was a passion that lasted a lifetime.
You, of course, have never left behind is, I believe, your love of chocolate.
No, I've never. I eat it every day. It's shoved onto the table after each meal out of the fridge in the summer, a big box like this with about six different, what we used to call tuppenny bars, you know, flakes, Kit Kats, everything, Aeros, everything you can think of. And
what's the cleverest bit of chocolate you've ever come across?
The cleverest? I think probably the very first chocolate bar, apart from the plain ones, like a Cadbury Dairy Milk, the very first one that was ever invented was the Dairy Milk Flake in 1921. I mean, I've never been to a chocolate bar. Obviously, they had a slit. Someone said, why don't we push the stuff through a thin slit and let it roll on top of it? I think it's wonderful. And that's been the bestseller for 60 years. You know, 21.
It's like Mars bars, you know, how they get the chocolate to stay.
Well, yeah, that's probably the greatest invention, 1932. Of course it is. Everyone should know these dates. I mean, it's all... Who wants to know when the kings of England were born and died? It's when the chocolate was invented. It really is. Kit Kats, 1935, all that sort of thing.
What was it?
Yeah, 1936. They were all... Every one of them, the great chocolate bars that you eat today, were invented in the 30s. Every single one of them. There's not a great one after. I mean, it is like the Italian Renaissance is to painting. The 30s is to chocolate.
But that was later on, when he was grown up and could eat all the chocolate he liked. Meanwhile, back at school, questions were being asked about his future.
Were you bright at school?
Not particularly, no. No, I was better at games than at work.
Yes.
Certainly no sign of any ability to write or do anything else. No, I was nothing at school. I wasn't even a house prefect.
You do quote in one of your books, your English report, indolent and illiterate.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes. I think the illiterate was a little bit unfair because I used to read avidly.
In my last school, Drepton, all the lavatories were outside in the outhouse where there was no heating at all. And in the winter, of course, it was freezing in there. And the prefects, they used to send us out, before they went to the lavatory themselves, they would send us out to warm the seat for them. So you took your trousers down and sat on the seat until the prefect was ready to come out there. And that's when I, of course, I took Dickens out and read most of Dickens, warming the seats of the lavatories for the prefects.
Oh, there was an American fellow who, when I read him, I couldn't turn the light off at night, a short story writer called Ambrose Bierce.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Who had a wonderful title to his collection, which was Can Such Things Be?
Yes.
And at age 11, I couldn't turn the light off.
Journeys of the imagination, and real journeys too.
We went on something that was then called the Public Schools Exploring Expedition to Newfoundland, mm-hmm. led by an intrepid and frightfully tough surgeon commander who was on Scott's expedition to the South Pole. It was enormous fun. It nearly killed us, you know, marching across Newfoundland and back with 110 pounds on our backs.
Wow.
Because in those days it was unexplored. Aeroplanes weren't flying around.
What did you want to be as a boy, as a schoolboy?
I hadn't the foggiest idea what I wanted to be. All I knew was that when my mother said, she said, do you want to go to Oxford or Cambridge? And in those days, you must remember, it was quite easy to get into them if you could pay. And I said, no, I don't. She said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to get a job that'll take me to distant lands.
And what was the first job that took you to distant lands?
That was the only job. I went up for an interview with the Shell Company for the Eastern Staff. And my housemaster, I remember my housemaster saying, I don't know what you're wasting your time with this for. There'll be people like the head boys of Eton and Harrow and God knows what there. But this imposing board of directors interviewing 60 boys for five places, they all brightened up when I said I'd won the heavyweight boxing at school. And that got me one of the places.
And where did it take you?
It took me to what was then Tanganyika, Dar es Salaam. Mm-hmm. Marvellous, you know.
Yes,
romantic, sure. Exciting. 3 weeks to get there on a ship.
And they thought your heavyweight boxing might be useful.
God knows what they thought. I think behind their thinking lay the fact that you were fit.
Yes.
And you could cope.
Right.
If you think of the time, which was 1933 or 4, there were virtually no aeroplanes flying you anywhere, no commercial airlines. And there was no television, of course. And so every faraway place like Africa was something you couldn't reach normally. And today, you can go anywhere in the world in 12 hours. It's impossible for young people today to understand the excitement of getting on a boat and travelling solidly for 3 or 4 weeks and finishing up in Africa among the coconut palms. People go there all the time now.
So you were in East Africa. You were only 18. What was your job? Was it an office job?
Well, it was a bit of everything. It was rather marvellous, a chap that age. You learned Swahili. You drove around and visited the sisal plantations and the diamond mines and things like that, to see that the chaps had the right kind of lubricating oil for their machinery. You didn't know an awful lot about it. You'd had a six-month course. It was so adventurous.
At that age, pretty terrific. Were you settled? Did you think this was going to be your career?
Yes, I did. Mm. I did, indeed.
How long did you carry on with the job?
Well, I was there about 2 years when the war broke out.
Yes.
And obviously, one joined up. So I got in a car and drove a long way through these, again, exciting, rutted roads and fording rivers up to Nairobi and joined the RAF, flying training.
Did you train in Nairobi?
Yes, I did.
Did my first bit of flying training up there in Little Tiger Moths. Again, wonderful. Flying all over Kenya in these little aeroplanes and seeing all the wildlife. They weren't in game reserves in those days. They were wandering all over the place, and we had to drive the zebras off the aerodrome before we could take off with the aeroplanes. It was great fun. I was put into fighters and sent to a squadron, which was in the Western Desert. But I wasn't very good out there. It didn't take long before I was shot down and crashed into the ground, you know, with a great burning aeroplane and crawling out. And I managed to get out all right, but I was quite a lot injured.
I was in hospital for 3 months, I think with a fracture and a face smashed in. It's my cozy little theory that because I was a fairly square young chap intent on a happy business life with the Shell Company, and that I started writing soon after that, that maybe the head helped. I've read lots of things about people who have been changed by bumps in the head. A woman hit her husband, had been blind all his life. She hit him over the head with a saucepan and he suddenly saw again. So you can't totally discount it, can you?
And you ended the war. You were sort of invalided out of active flying. You ended up in the United States as assistant air attaché, which sounds rather a glamorous post.
Well, I started up in that post. I didn't last very long because I'm a tactless sort of fellow, and that's the one thing a diplomat mustn't be, you know. I got shunted out of that, but I came back rather quickly working for the quiet Canadian, Sir William Stevenson.
Ah, yes.
In intelligence, yes, which was much more fun.
Didn't I read that you were a spy?
No, that's an ugly word, a spy. No, I did. I worked for British SIS, yes, last half of the war when I was injured and couldn't fly. I was very lucky because my first little book I wrote was called The Gremlins, and Eleanor Roosevelt read it to her grandchildren and loved this book. And so I got invited to the White House. And my job was to try to help Winston Churchill to get on with FDR and tell Winston what was in the old boy's mind. I was really not spying against the Americans. I was trying to create amity.
This wasn't where your flair for fiction grew up, was it?
No, I couldn't muck about with that sort of thing. But it was incredible for a young chap to know those sort of people.
The flair for fiction had been revealed after an extraordinary meeting and an even more extraordinary lunch.
And I was sitting in my room in the embassy, and a door opened and a little round face poked in with thick glasses and said, "May I come in?" And I really did think that this little man was going to ask for a job of some sort, not that I could have given it to him. And he said, "My name is C.S. Forrester." And I said, "Oh, go on, you know." And he said, "No, honestly." And being an avid reader, one of my gods was walking into the room. And he said, "Look, will you come out to lunch with me and tell me your most exciting adventure in the war?
and I'll write it, and it'll be in the Saturday Evening Post, and it'll be good for Britain.
Yes.
And I said, yes, I jolly well will. And so we sat down, and we, having our lunch, we were eating duck. And he was trying to make notes and shovel this stuff into his mouth, and it was a mess, and I was trying to talk. I said, look, if I scribble this down this evening and send it to you, you can put it in proper shape. Would that help? He said, well, that'd be marvellous. Would you do that? I said, of course I will. And so I did, and a little story seemed to emerge from it, and I sent it to him. And a week later, I got a lovely letter from him and a cheque for $1,000 saying he hadn't touched it and he'd sold it to the Saturday Evening Post for me, and they wanted more.
My grandfather didn't just write stories. He made up whole new words.
You're credited with inventing the word gremlin.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, it may be true, and it probably is, but I don't like to take too much credit for that. I wrote a little story about creatures early in the war, and it was called The Gremlins, and somebody showed it to Walt Disney, and he fell in love with it and was going to make a film. In fact, I went out to Hollywood and, at his expense with RAF permission and stayed. This silly young man in RAF uniform staying in a suite in the Beverly Hills Hotel with a car provided by Walt and seeing him every day. Nothing much came of the film. They spent, I don't know how many million dollars on it and scrapped it. Uh-huh. And that was the end of it.
But these were the original gremlins, the ones that used to get in the machinery and climb out on the wings and do all that damage.
Yes, and Disney drew the first pictures of them.
So with the money from the pictures, my grandfather was able to buy some pictures of his own.
Every time I sold a short story, I would take that money and buy a painting and hang it up and look at it. And then I usually took so long to write another story that I would need the money and I'd have to sell the painting. So in the beginning, I never got to keep any of them very long. But I had some passing through my hands. I mean, in those days, in 1947, 8, you could buy anything. I mean, I had Bonnards, Ruers, I had a Matisse, which I just paid a few hundred for, Big Oil, Vuillards, I had a little Renoir, and I had to let them all go. But gradually, as you made a little more money and you saved some money, I was able to save a picture or two. And then when I made a bit more money, I began collecting what I loved quite seriously.
And the interest from Hollywood didn't disappear either. Many, including Alfred Hitchcock, Tim Burton and Steven Spielberg, have turned my grandfather's stories into films. And he did write other screenplays, although he only really enjoyed one of them.
It was You Only Live Twice, and it was Sean Connery's last one.
Yes.
He did, and we went to Japan, and you live in such luxury when you do a Bond film. And you go in helicopters everywhere, tops of mountains and everything. Yeah, it's enormous fun.
Saltzman said to go through screenwriters like a meat chopper, but author Raoul Dahl can turn his pen to sterner stuff.
I've written a lot of stories with sin, not a lot with sex or sadism.
Wonder how you're managing with the three S's, yeah.
Well, I don't pay any attention to sadism in it. I don't think we have any.
It'll be the first Bond film where there hasn't been a lot of...
Will it?
People being bashed around.
Oh, they get bashed around. When one man knocks another man out in a fight, that isn't really sadism.
No, it's good clean fun.
Yes. When I went in, I said, he wants a woman, doesn't he, to chase around and fall in love with. And they said, well, three would be better. And that's quite easy.
You did Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Yeah, that wasn't much fun.
Was it?
No. but I'm not in love with cinema directors, let's just put it that way.
Right.
Except for the James Bond one.
Yeah.
Things happen to film.
Yes.
That's why it's so much nicer, you know, if you're an ordinary writer, to stick to writing books and stories, and nobody can screw around with them, can they?
By then, my grandfather was a bit like James Bond himself. He was a handsome war hero, and he'd married a film star, my wonderful grandmother, Patricia Neal. But life, as we know, is hardly ever all happy, and so it was with Roald. In fact, three really awful things happened in a short space of time. First, Roald and Patricia's son, my Uncle Theo, was just 4 months old when his pram was hit by a taxi cab in New York City.
Got severe
head injuries and developed into hydrocephalus.
Which is what? What's hydrocephalus?
Well, it's too much cerebrospinal fluid in the ventricles and you get pressure in there. Your brain suffers damage unless you're very swift and quick to relieve the pressure. And they did have a shunt or a tube with a valve in it where you could drain the fluid out of the ventricle. But they weren't very competent, the shunts they had in those days, and he had to keep going back and having new operations. He had five, because the shunts kept blocking, and I said, well, I mean, bugger this, we must be able to make a better shunt than this, and so I thought of a lovely man who I knew was an inventor, who I'd been flying model aeroplanes with a couple of years before, and what I'd admired so much about him was that instead of buying these tiny model aeroplane engines, he made them all himself. So I went along to him and I said, Stanley Wade, his name's in Wickham. I said, how about you doing this? And he said, yes, all right. And we had the enormous advantage of the head of neurosurgery at Great Ormond Street, Kenneth Till, who was a tremendous cooperator in this, you see. And Stanley slaved away at this thing, and we, you know, he really did it, not me. Produced this splendid little valve, which it's still used in Great Ormond Street on children. It was used and still is extensively, especially in underdeveloped countries like India and Kenya, where they can't afford to pay £100 for the American valve, which is a profit thing.
Yes.
No, it's not profit at all. Mm.
Then Roald and Patricia's eldest daughter, my Aunt Olivia, died of measles encephalitis when she was only 7.
When she got measles, there was an epidemic at school. You didn't think too much of it. And she was recovering from it. And suddenly began to lose the use of her hands and her speech a little bit. And we thought, well, I thought nothing of it, really. I went up to work in my hut, and within a couple of hours, she was unconscious. And she was dead within the day.
And then Patricia, my grandmother, had 3 terrible cerebral aneurysms, which left her in a coma.
She had an 8-hour operation, and then she was unconscious for 20 days, about halfway through, when the pulse got a bit stronger. I said to Charlie Carton, the surgeon, I said, well, she's going to live now, isn't she? And he said, yes, she is, but I'm not sure I've done you a favour. He said, look at the x-rays. And there was a splodge about the size of a shilling on each of them, you see. And he said, that's blood. He said, I don't think she'll stand an operation. I said, well, what happens if you don't operate? And he used a funny phrase. He said, then she will succumb for certain. I said, well, then you've bloody well got to operate, haven't you? Well, no doctor likes losing a patient on the table. And no Hollywood doctor likes losing a Hollywood film star on the table. That makes it even worse, doesn't it? But he was jolly brave. He did it.
In a situation like this, then, therefore, the consequence that you're warned of was that even if she lived, she'd be a vegetable. Now, she's not a vegetable. I mean, she's back now. She's working.
Yeah.
What part did you play in that?
She certainly looked like one when she came around.
Really?
Yes, she was completely aphasic. She couldn't talk. But the surgeon gave me one great tip. He said, get cracking. Every week that's lost in rehabilitation is lost forever, because after 2 years, there's virtually no more improvement. And we started off out there with a bit of speech therapy, but I got her home pretty quickly. And I called up the local hospital and said, speech therapists. And a nice girl came round, and as you can guess, she's busy, and she said, I can give you an hour a week. I thought, Christ, she's not going to get anywhere with an hour a week, is she? And so that's when I called in all the friends, you know, and we gave her 6 hours a day with amateurs. And that did it.
Not long afterwards, his beloved mama, my namesake Sophie, died. Here he is with Ivo Niha in an interview on Dutch television.
There's no reason to collapse if anything awful happens. You have to go on. Of course you do. I think it helps if you were brought up having to fight through the war. That toughens you up, tempers you.
The things you've been going through in your personal life, there was no humour in there, was it?
No, not in the personal life, not in the bad parts of it, no, but there always was in the good parts.
Yeah.
Throughout it all, Rouault continued to write. He wrote many short stories for adults, his tales of the unexpected, but he'd also begun to write for his children.
I'd never written a children's book. I used to make a point of trying to tell them, invent a new one every night for them. And when I found I was telling them one about a giant peach that grew and grew and grew and a little boy, they were asking for me to go on with it the next night. And so I just simply said to myself, well, why don't I have a go at writing this, you know? And I enjoyed doing it and finished the book, James and Giant Peach.
They beg for it still every night, and it's come to them saying, well, Daddy, if you won't tell us a proper story, tell us a rushing-out story, just one as you're leaving the room, and just one that'll take you as long as to walk from the bed to the door. And so they catch me that way, you see, and I start one at the bed, and by the time I've got the door, I'm into it a little bit, you know. Last week, a boy was born, and every year of his life, instead of growing bigger, he grew smaller by an inch a year. And so by the time he was 8, he was minute, you see, about an inch high. And his sister was born, and she started to grow bigger by an inch a year. And so by the time she was 8, I don't know what she was, about 10 feet, you see. And that they rather liked. And there was possibly a germ of something in that. And I went on with it the next night.
Which interests you more, or do you have to choose, writing for children or writing for adults?
Well, when I was writing for adults, I loved it. I liked it very much. Now, I think, trying to compare them both, I think writing for children is far more exciting because you have an audience that responds in all sorts of immediate and tangible ways. My mail, for instance, you don't get mail from adults. I have to keep a secretary entirely to answer children's mail. They write lovely things. They thank you for the book or the books. And then nearly every child you'll find almost automatically says, the part I liked best was. And then they all like the bits where nasty things happen to horrid people. You know, two aunts getting squashed flat by a peach or something like that. The very bits, as a matter of fact, that are strongly objected to by librarians when the book first comes out, you know.
Do you see it as any part of your job as a children's writer to prepare them for the hard, realistic world of being an adult?
No, it's not. I don't see anything as my job when I write for children except to entertain them as best I possibly can, make them laugh, make them listen, and, oh, yes, and also, I must add, to try my best to teach them to love reading books.
My crusade is to teach small children to love books so much that it becomes a habit and they realise that books are worth reading. Books, if you're going to be anything, they are vital in life. If you are a fit reader, there are always times in people's lives when they are lonely or ill, and if you are able to read books and enjoy them and love them, you've got the whole world of literature at your feet. You go and find another book to read and you can get lost in it.
I think anything that tries to prevent a child from living in a world of fantasy while they've got the chance is wrong. They're very shortly going to have to enter a very rough, materialistic world where fantasy doesn't have much part. And I think they should be given all of it that they can get.
He did most of his writing here in Great Missenden in Buckinghamshire, looking out over the field in which we're standing. This was the view he saw every day as he walked from his house to his famous writing hut.
Every day for the past 35 years, twice a day, I've wandered up to my little hut. It's a lovely place to work, because it's small and tight and dark and the curtains are always drawn and it's a kind of womb. You know, you go up here and you disappear and get lost for a couple of hours at a stretch. It may not be pretty or tidy, and it certainly hasn't been cleaned and the floor hasn't been swept for 5 years at least.
So it's full of everything. The only thing I did remove about 2 years ago, we had a goat that got in and there was some goat droppings on the floor and I thought, well, I better get a dustpan and sweep those up, and I did.
This old table, which never gets touched or dusted, over the years, it just gathers things. This, for example, is a 50-year-old ball of silver paper of immense weight. When I had my first job in London, I used to have a chocolate bar for lunch every day, and I simply rolled the bits of paper around it. I don't know how it survived, but there it is. This is one of the heads of one of my femurs, which has been sawn off. I've had them both done.
And you use it, or don't you?
And this is a prosthesis. This is what they put into your hip after they saw that off. And this one went wrong, and they took it out of me. This is some chippings taken out of my spine from a disc operation. I've had six discs. This is one. And that's actually what they take out when you have a disc operation.
But to use that as a paperweight, that's rather a macabre thing, isn't it?
It's not macabre to me at all. No, no, it's not. If you see it all the time, it doesn't worry you. It makes me laugh. I've taken a great deal of trouble with the actual chair I sit in and the place I put my feet. This is a trunk which I've filled with blocks of wood, so it's hard, you see. And that I put my feet on and like to push on it like everybody does. And so that it won't go away, I've tied it to the legs of my chair with bits of wire. And so it won't push any further away than that, you see. And that's just the right distance for my legs.
And I always use six pencils, and they always have to be sharpened before I start. Finally, you get settled. You get into a sort of nest and get really comfortable. And then you're away. Pencil doesn't very often touch the paper. It's looking and musing and correcting, and then you do a little writing, and in the end you get something done. But your concentration is fairly intense. You're lost. You're into this world of the story that you happen to be doing.
In the winter, if it gets very cold, I get into a sleeping bag. You really do get into it. It's quite fun. You go back. I go back 60-odd years, you see, to do it and become 6 and 7 and 8 again. It's very important, this, because most adults have forgotten how children are thinking. And I certainly see myself totally on the side of children.
To me, there is no question that the enemy is the adult to every child. And so when I set out in Matilda to mock and decry and humiliate parents and a teacher, they absolutely love it. The reason they love it is because all these subconscious things are coming back in their minds. They say, my God, yes, yes, your parents are absolute hell, and so are teachers. And it works, you know. Of course, you have to have some nice ones as well to balance it out, because you don't want to show them that all parents and all teachers are horrid. Most people think they understand children and remember what it was like to be a child. But I swear to you, they don't. If they did, then everyone could write children's books. It's not so much an art as a knack, I think. The truth is that very few accomplished writers can write successful children's books. And don't think for a moment they haven't tried, because they have. I mean, people like Graham Greene and John Updike, and they've all had a go at it. But they cannot really remember totally what it was like to be 6 or 7 years old. There's probably a fairly large child in me, and that's why I giggle at all the funny things. I tend to be on the coarse side, because I think children, they're very coarse in their talk together. They change when they're talking to adults, you know, they hide it. But they are very coarse, and they're semi-civilized, so I try to speak to them as they speak to each other. There are certain words they laugh aloud at in Revolting Rhymes. I said, her eyelid flickers.
she whips a pistol from her knickers. Now, the simple word knickers makes every child hoot with laughter. Something that will shock an adult won't shock a child at all. He'll roar with laughter at it. And I know, I think, what those things are.
In the BFG, for example, I decided to write about farting. Well, I did that because I know very well that if there's one thing in this world that makes a child laugh, it is somebody farting. I mean, you're laughing yourself at that. And I don't know why it is that it's a very funny thing, but it just happens it is. You wouldn't write about it for adults because they would pretend anyway to be very superior about it and turn their noses up and say, you know, that's childish, that's childish. Right, that's where your clue is, it's childish, you see.
You can become as crude as you like and as coarse as you like and almost as cruel, if you like, as long as there is a burst of laughter at the same time. It's got to be there. You cannot write about something grisly unless it's funny. But if you can make it grisly and funny, then they love it, you see. So do I. That's why I do it. I mean, like Mrs. Twit feeding her husband, telling him he's getting spaghetti, and actually she's gone out in the garden and got a whole lot of worms and put tomato sauce over them and eats them and says the spaghetti's moving. Well, I know some adults who get quite ill when they read that, but no child ever gets ill. They hoot with laughter at it.
I would worry about going too far if there was no laughs in it. Everything that happens in the way of violence has a joke in it. It makes you laugh.
Yeah, are funny bits the most important thing, then?
I think they're very, very important to captivate a child's attention and to hold it. I can't give them a book without laughs.
The Witches is a very comic book, but it's also a violent one. Do you have any rules for coping with violence in your books?
I can have lots of people killed, but they won't be killed in a conventional way. I'm quite prepared to have them killed in the most grisly possible way, like having them little boys from Eton pulled out of the windows and eaten by giants, bones crunched up and everything, or a child falling into a chocolate-making machine and coming out as fudge. That's fine, as long as there is a whopping great laugh at the same time.
So do you see yourself as primarily an entertainer or an educator or something in between?
Nothing in between. Totally an entertainer. Totally. And a little bit of morality slipped into, for example, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. But it only happened to slip in. I wouldn't ever attempt it.
Serious themes do run through your stories, don't they? There's an awful lot about justice, quite ruthless justice at times. The Magic Finger, where duck hunters are turned into ducks and are hunted by ducks who are turned into hunters.
Right. I feel strongly about that, but then most nice people do feel strongly about the human being being probably the most predatory animal in the world.
Well, how much then are you using what you write, not just to entertain, but to inculcate ideas into your readers?
I think you've got to put little thoughts in children's minds. They've got to think occasionally for themselves. They're not believe everything that teachers tell them, that we are a wonderful race of people, because we're not.
One of the worst crimes, it seems, you can commit if you're one of your less pleasant characters in your books is to be a grouch, to be a grumpy kind of character, like George's grandmother, for instance, who finally disappears into nothing, and we're not very sorry because she's such a miserable old baggage.
Oh, the nasties have to get done in. In fact, you set out to make them as nasty as you possibly can so that when they get done in, it's sweeter than ever. I mean, you couldn't stand it if the lovely person didn't win.
Why can't we stand that? Is it because it's really not like life? Because you and I both know that when you look around you, you see terrible people who appear to be winning and lovely people who appear to be suffering far more than they ought to if there was any justice in the world.
That's a very good point you've made. I don't know what the answer to that is. We are surrounded by horrible people who win. And I'm very, very wary of extremely rich men who pretend that they're lovely because they're not. They've crushed people to get where they are. A fiction writer doesn't write about his own experiences. He makes it up.
And yet in reading Boy, this is obviously an outsider looking at that book,
yeah.
But in reading Boy there are so many things that you write about that trigger images from your fictional work. I'm thinking of the horrible people, the disgusting Mrs. Pratchett, who runs the sweet shop. And so many of your people in your fictional stories are equally disgusting. The Twits, for instance, who are horrendous, nasty people.
I'm glad you mentioned the Twits, because anyone who's listening, I want to tell you that the gent who's talking to me now has a beard himself.
I nearly shaved it off before I came here.
Yes, I mean, he would be a very, very nice-looking fellow if he didn't have it. I mean, there's no question that it is disgusting and repulsive. But the funny thing is about people with beards is they don't seem to be ashamed of them at all. It's the only unprepossessing thing about a man which he isn't ashamed of. I mean, if he has stick-out ears or a wonky nose or anything else, he's ashamed of it. And yet he goes around with a beard and they're proud of it. I don't understand it, because it is disgusting, there's no question about it. And you can't even see what the fellow looks like. You can't even see them blushing behind all this ruddy hair, you know, they've got over their faces. No, it is impossible.
Have you got a razor to hand at all?
No, you can do that when you get home.
I was thinking of cutting my throat.
What are your other occupations? You live in the country. What do you do when you're not sitting in your little hut writing?
I have a pretty deep interest in wine.
Yes, yes.
In 18th century English furniture. In pictures of all kinds, but mainly of this century. Plants and gardening,
yes.
Which has, in the last 20 years, has blossomed out into cultivating and breeding a certain kind of orchid known as Phalaenopsis.
You're also a gambler.
Yes, I've been a gambler all my life. I'll gamble, actually, on anything. Horses, dogs. I once bred racing greyhounds just after the war. I had 20 or 30 of them.
Successfully?
Not particularly, no. No, he was a gambler.
But that was the gamble.
He doesn't care whether he's successful or not, as long as he can gamble. Oh, it was enormous fun.
I remember my grandfather as tall and imposing and creaky, but someone to who there was always an air of magic. There was always some mischief or trouble that would happen. You know, one of my strongest memories of childhood is sitting at his long kitchen table, which was a farmhouse table, with him presiding at the top in a big burgundy-coloured armchair, because he had lots of war wounds, so he would sit at the top, normally being kind of cantankerous or fiendish about something, and he wrote me very funny letters. Throughout his life, my grandfather wrote letters. As a schoolboy and young man, he wrote them to his mother and sisters. As an adult, he wrote them to his children when they were at boarding school. As a famous author, when he wasn't writing books, he wrote letters to his fans and he wrote to the newspapers. He provoked with his letters and sometimes with his words, but for me, he was sturdy, present, mould.
Welcome back to Roald and Quentin, who we were talking to earlier. And who are you? What are you doing here?
My name's Sophie and this is Mould.
What? This is who?
Mould.
I'm her grandfather.
Mould? Mouldy?
She's called me Mould all my life, yes. All her life. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming along and introducing Mouldy to us. Here.
She's the original Sophie from my book, The BFG.
So you are a heroine of a book?
With the little spectacles and everything.
Already? That's one. Would you mind sitting here this morning while we chat?
He was the maker of banana and bacon sandwiches. He would make hot air balloons from bits of paper and candles and we would send them up into the sky. He would write our names in weed killer on the grass and tell us the fairies had been. And he was always ready to invent a new story.
I was talking to my old friend Martha Gellhorn, and she said a funny thing. She said, because my name is in the phone book as Martha and not M. Gellhorn, they know I'm a woman, and so I keep getting dirty telephone calls late at night, you see. Very nervous young men call me up and say horrible, beastly things to me, you see. It's about 3 a.m, and I say, oh, come on, belt up. I'm old enough to be your grandmother, you see. And that's all she... And I remember driving and I thinking, well, by golly, there must be a story in that, you know, because it's happening to people all over the place, isn't it? You see, when you get a thing like that, a seed, there's got to be 50 ways of of making a story out of that, at least. Little shoots going out all the time.
50 different ways it could go.
There's got to be.
Right, so what about what?
Well, she goes, let's say she goes into, the chap on the phone obviously has to have a slightly funny way of saying certain words, or as an intonation or something, which is right. She goes into Harrods to buy a piece of beef, and he says to her, the young man, do you want it boned and rolled? She says, that's him. That is him. I can't. It's got to be. I mean, the way he says rolled or whatever thing. I must have said that. And so.
Boned would have been a better.
Yeah. And so. so she gets a beef, slides off, and at that stage, obviously, it's very easy to find the chap's name and his number from the supervisor. You can go up and you can say, he's been so nice to me, I'd like to send him. Anyway, you can get over that.
Right.
Then I think then she would go home, and at 3 a.m, she'd call him. And she'd say, what's it like for you to be called by me? I'm trying to make this up, so it's obvious. And that would shake him a bit, wouldn't it?
Yes.
And he would be speechless, terrified, won't he? She'll say, it was very easy to get your number. From where I am now, from the big book. I died this morning. Something like that, you know.
So he was sort of amazing, and he was 6'7", so he was also enormous. He was treated like one of the Beatles when I was at school, so if he ever came to visit me at school, children would flock and scream and shriek. He was always fantastically rude and irreverent about adults, and that was one of the things that made him so lovable. To children, you felt that he'd always be on your side.
Were you frightened as a child? Badly?
Frightened by the dark, and also walking home alone in the dark at night in the winter with the high trees moving in the wind. Mm. Terrified of that. Being frightened of anything is really, when you come down to it, being frightened of death.
Mm.
And the older you get, the less frightened of death.
Oh, that's true.
You get.
Yes, that's right.
It really depends very much on who you see dying around you. If people close to you die, then you get less and less frightened of death.
He died surrounded by his family in Oxford 26 years ago, and he is buried here at the Church of St. Peter and St. Paul in Great Missenden. Since he died, his fame has grown. Around the world, more than 200 million copies of his books have been sold in 58 languages. Films, operas, stage shows and musicals based on his work are still being made. Every year, thousands of children visit the Roald Dahl Museum and Story Centre, a place promoting literacy and creativity, and the charities he founded on causes dear to his heart raise millions of pounds. And online, in a development that would have astonished him, his presence continues to touch lives around the world every minute of every day. But I remember him as Mould, my grandfather, who when he was devoted to someone was truly devoted to them, and who even when he was cantankerous and in pain was still doing magical things right up to the end of his extraordinary life.
When eventually you do finally have to give up or want to give up, whichever comes first...
When I die.
When you die.
Yeah.
Is there any particular way in which you want to have been remembered?
Well, you can quote Oscar Wilde and say, when I am gone, I hope it will be said, my sins were scarlet, but my books were red.
Just because you find that night's not favourite doesn't mean that you just have to grin and bear it. If you always take it on the chin and wear it,
I do feel now, in my old age, I'm 72 and a half, I am beginning to feel, the first time in my life, that the children's books particularly, some of them, when I'm dead, will be some sort of classic-y things. I think so. I feel that now. It's not a pretentious or conceited thing to say. It's the way it looks, that's all.
Watch with glittering eyes the whole world around you, because the greatest secrets are always hidden in the most unlikely places. Those who don't believe in magic will never find it.
At the end of George's Marvellous Medicine, you say, George felt quite trembly. He knew something tremendous had taken place that morning. For a few brief moments, he had touched, with the very tips of his fingers, the edge of a magic world. Is that what you want your young readers to do?
Oh, yes, absolutely, yes. They've got to touch the edge of a magic world. Magic is a wonderful thing when you're young. It is. They've got to live partly in a fantasy world while they've got the chance. Because they're never going to have the chance again when they grow up.
In the slip of their boat, there's a tiny big fault. The seeds of our war in the creek of our floorboard.
I imagine that if he was alive now, he would celebrate his 100th birthday with some really good red wine, a lot of chocolate, and surrounded by his family, because he really adored family.
If you're stuck in your story and want to get out, you don't have to cry, you don't have to shout. Your little you do a lot, you must let a little thing like this will stop you. If you sit around and let them get on top of you, won't change a thing.
I think the thing about grandparents, when you're an adult and you have your own children and your grandparents are gone, you think, God, there's so many things I would have loved to have talked to them about. So I think I'd just bend his ear and he'd probably say, oh, do shut up.
And that's not right.
I'd ask him tons of questions, annoy the hell out of him, and I imagine we'd drink quite a lot of red wine.
Happy 100th birthday, Roald Dahl.
Thanks for listening to the Seriously podcast. To find out more, please visit bbc.co.uk/seriously. Until next time.